It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
The Olympics.
Last week, I went to a family barbecue we have this annual family barbecue in the summertime during the Caribbean festival here called Caribana. We have our own like little Caribana barbecue, and my family goes to the festival, and then they come back home and we all barbecue. Anyways, I went this year. It ended up being a bit more low key than typical years. So I ended up sitting on the couch with my dad the entire time watching the Olympics for like 6 straight hours. I know that makes me sound really antisocial. I promise I'm not. But this whole year I was kind of like, ugh, Olympics, fuck that. Like, I don't want to watch that. Jingoism, whatever. But then I sat down and started watching them and I was like, oh, it's kind of good.
No, there's definitely a reason people like them. I think the Olympics are one of those things that, like, similar to when I was a kid, I would just decide I didn't like a food, and then I would spend my whole life thinking I didn't like that food. But then I recently realized I love hot dogs. I think if I watched the Olympics, I could similarly have that experience, but my Taurus ass just, like, hasn't come around to letting go of my thought that I hate the Olympics.
Not to deviate, but you did mention another food the other day that I thought was really funny. Dumplings. You didn't like dumplings as a kid, which is so random.
It was a texture thing, and now I'm obsessed with dumplings.
Hannah's palate is widening.
To the most basic, universally beloved foods. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, no, I just think it made me wish I had, because basically we don't really have a living room. We have like an attic living room. So we're not in a place of, oh, put on the TV and just like walk around and listen to the TV. But no, this made me want
that. A crawl space vibe.
It's giving panic room. This made me really crave like a TV that I could put the Olympics on just all day long and just kind of like on and off watch it passively. It's just, I don't know. Certain sports are just so riveting. I was watching the swimming and like they go underwater and they look like little crazy little fish flopping around down there. And the Canadian won. And unfortunately, it just made me super nationalistic. I was like, yeah, Summer McIntosh. Anytime a Canadian wins, I get so excited. And it's like, it is just kind of nice to be a bit proud of where you've come from.
I jumped on the Raptors bandwagon for 3 games, and I loved it for those 3 games. Like, I understand. The thing about the Olympics is that it really just demands so much cultural attention in a way that I find annoying, because I find these massive sports events make it really hard for people who aren't that interested in sports to be around, because they're just, like, no other interest can take up that much attention from everybody. Like, why do sports people get to make their interest be the thing that everyone talks about? Like, why is it a water cooler moment to talk about sports?
No, my favorite term that I've made up myself and I'm very proud of is sports hegemony. Like, I think, you know, I was trying to explain to someone that I think Love Island should also dominate that kind of scene. Like, I think reality TV should also hold that space in our culture. And they were like, what are you talking about? And I was like, it's the hegemony speaking. Like, you can't even fathom a world in which sports aren't the dominant interest.
Well, so. Yeah. And I mean, I do think that Love Island is brilliant because it functions like the Olympics. Like, it's a long spanning event and there's things happening constantly, but it appeals to me.
We've definitely talked about this on the podcast before. Like, we have our three things that we hit on all the time.
I compare reality TV to sports constantly. It's like my favorite thing to do. It's my favorite kind of argument to throw at men that are like, reality TV is rotting your brains. And I'm like, you watching people compete on the screen is no different from me watching two housewives throw wine at each other.
But on that note, I loved the Olympics and watching gymnastics and Simone Biles throw her body around in the air was crazy. And it made me proud of America. Track and field is also just riveting. Like, there were two times that it would be like a 1500 meter run, and the person at the very front, who's at the very front the whole time, loses steam right near the end and then ends up dead last. And it happened two times, probably multiple times actually, but the two times I watched, and it's like I was like screaming for them. I was like, why did you do that?
That's if I learned anything from my elementary school track career, it's that one doesn't sprint at the beginning if it's a longer length race.
Yeah, one does not
save your energy.
One is not in a place of sprint.
No, certainly not.
For non-sprints.
You're an Olympian.
I think it just made me miss, like, monoculture and, like, just the culture of the TV. Because, like, yeah, anytime I go to my family's house, I get really into whatever they're watching. So, like, we often watch UFC because my cousin has, like, pay-per-view. And I get so into it, I'm like enthralled, and I feel like this is probably what people felt when OJ was in his freaking Ford Bronco, and this is what I felt in 2010 when Sidney Crosby got the goal in hockey. And I hate hockey, but I was so happy in that moment.
I remember that moment. So that was actually the Olympics where I decided I thought the Olympics were done, because we were hosting them in Vancouver, and I remember hearing that the mayor of Vancouver was like displacing homeless people to beautify the city for the Olympics. And that was when my like grade 7 ass was like, yeah, and that's why the Olympics are stupid. But I do remember being at my family friend's house when that goal was scored, and it was a huge deal. And I had to be like, you know what? That is a big deal.
The Olympics are so fun when you're from a rich country and they're not happening in your city. Because you better know, like, Toronto already is so trigger happy with just flattening the entire city. Imagine what would happen if the Olympics came here. They'd get rid of, like, every house in the whole city. They'd just be, like, unsightly. Put a gray condo there. Make it gorgeous. Get rid of the trees.
If Toronto hosts the Olympics, I will not be here. I'll tell you that.
I'm already planning on it.
Speaking of things that lots of people were obsessed with talking about and got lots of hype, and I was like, whatever. Today's episode is on NFTs. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is on When Art Meets the Internet. Is the sun rising on a new creative era, or did it set before it even began? If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps a lot. Two or three years ago, when normies started asking themselves if they should start investing in crypto, there became a whole market of podcasts and articles breaking down the blockchain for non-tech bros. NFTs in particular seemed like a good entry point for the average person, with celebrities like Justin Bieber, Paris Hilton, Snoop Dogg, and Reese Witherspoon all pushing them as like the next big thing. However, you and I, Maya, being characteristically cynical about most new technological advancements, chose to largely remain ignorant about all of this. And flash forward to 2024, it seems like most people have come to share that cynicism.
We're always right.
But because of the nature of this very show, it means that now is the perfect time for us to finally talk about NFTs. And so today's episode is on NFTs, their relationship to the art world, and the implications of owning a JPEG.
I don't get it.
So, Maya, because you've already told me, I know you don't know anything about NFTs.
Oh, you caught me.
But do you want to scrape, like, the corners of your mind and tell me your, like, base understanding of them?
Okay. Oh, you got my ass. This is gonna be really bad. I know that there's, like, a monkey, and he looks kind of pissed, and there's many variations of him. Sometimes he has piercings.
Oh, a bored ape.
He has green hair.
Wait, and, I'm sorry. Do you think that all NFTs are
no?
Are
this is like the limit of my knowledge. An ape, and he's angry.
You're not and wrong. Then,
and then people sell him. That is as far as I fucking gone. I was like, I saw that monkey. I was like, that shit is hideous. I'm out. And that was the end. But I think being in New York, it's come to my attention that actually a lot of people there are very invested in NFTs, or were back in the day, and like were quite successful off of them. So mm-hmm. I think now I need to kind of step my pussy up. So actually, I was really excited for this episode because I was like, well, this is the perfect opportunity for me to learn about them so I can, in casual conversation, flaunt some knowledge beyond there's an ugly monkey.
Yeah, well, you can think of this as blockchains for bimbos, essentially. Next time you're on a Tinder date, you can bring up this most basic understanding of what an NFT is, which is what I'm going to provide you.
Thank you so much.
Until incredibly recently, I had about the same understanding of NFTs. I once went on a terrible Tinder date with a guy who spent a very long time explaining them to me and then showed me the Major League Baseball trophy NFTs that he bought. And I was like, where am I? What am I doing with my life? I could not understand why somebody would spend money on a picture of a trophy. But I'm going to try and step into his mindset today. So I know our more technologically literate listeners are probably going to roll their eyes at this like very elementary explainer I'm about to give, but I'm doing this for all the girls that went, ugly monkey? I don't think so. So NFT stands for non-fungible token. Fungible is an economics term for something that can be exchanged for an exact equivalent. So like something with copies. Two quarters of the same currency are fungible because if we like traded them, we would still have something of the exact same value. And this like can apply to a lot of cryptocurrency as well, because if we traded two bitcoins, they would also be fungible. They're each other's equivalent. So something non-fungible would be something unique without an exact duplicate of identical value. It's like something that's one of a kind. So an original piece of art, for example, is non-fungible because there is no exact replica that could be like swapped out for it. But for non-fungibility to exist online has been pretty impossible for most of the internet's history. Can you take a gander as to why?
In the age of mechanical reproduction, things can be reproduced quite easily, especially in the digital ephemera. Therefore, it's very easy to make an exact copy of something on the internet because famously the internet is the Wild Wild West.
Well, exactly. I mean, like, anything can be screenshot. Any JPEG can be, like, downloaded and reshared. There's not really any way for there to be one version of something. It's very, very difficult to achieve.
My girl Mona Lisa is like every other girl now.
Yeah, she's no longer one of a kind. And so, like, why do you think if we were to put ourselves in the shoes of digital artists, why this might be an issue?
Well, because your art can be recreated quite easily, and therefore it's difficult to patent your art, difficult in the world of like intellectual property to maintain a hold over it, and we're seeing that become more and more of a crisis these days. I have a video about it that you should all go watch, putting a token in the jar, a non-fungible token.
Wow. No, putting a Bitcoin in the jar?
Putting a Bitcoin in the jar.
A Bitcoin in the jar.
In the YouTube jar for those who are first-time listeners. I have a jar that every time I mention YouTube, I put it in the jar. The Bitcoin.
Pretty much that. It's also very difficult to convince someone to buy a fungible digital object because if it's copyable and it could be accessed for free, there's very little incentive to pay for it. Like, people aren't necessarily in the business of just giving money for something that they can access already.
Well, To once again reference my favorite scholar, Walter Benjamin, and his essay, Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, he posits that art historically has had an aura around it, which is the space that it occupies, the physical space that it occupies. And so much of the art world and so much of the currency surrounding art has to do with that aura and has to do with obtaining that kind of spiritual value to the artwork that, yeah, is completely lost when it goes onto the web.
That, and like, and I think that that's like a very beautiful, very optimistic view of people's motives when they're buying and trading within the traditional art world. But what I think some of the story around NFTs also expose is that as much as we like to think that it is about the aura, for a lot of people, it's about the cachet that is attached to the painting more so than it is the feeling.
Totally. I think back in the day, the cachet was wrapped up in the aura. Now that no longer has to be a thing because the aura has been killed, basically.
Yes. So I think when we think about someone who's already working as a digital artist, but whose work primarily exists online and it isn't like existing in physical form, a lot of the kind of issues that come with that are wrapped up in just being able to sell your work and giving people an excuse to buy it, because you can't really own something that's just digital. You could sell work perhaps to be used in something for advertisements, but you can't really like just sell a JPEG as it is.
Or can you?
Well, we'll see. And in the art business, where, you know, exclusivity and scarcity are often integral to a work's value, this has just been the dilemma around like trying to make digital art a thing. So this is a quote from a 1990 article for Art Journal called The Digital Revolution, Art in the Computer Age by Cynthia Goodman. And she writes, "The art gallery and museum establishments have dampened somewhat the art community's enthusiasm for the new medium, which is digital art. The resistance of art dealers is based largely on very practical questions of marketability, particularly the difficulty in assigning a financially profitable price to a work of art that is virtually endlessly reproducible." That's from 1990. And it took until 2014 for someone to find a solution. So digital artist Kevin McCoy and technologist Anil Dash paired up for this annual event held at the New Museum called 7 on 7, where they pair artists and technologists together to, quote, make something new and then present it at a conference. It's kind of like a hackathon. Like, they get a time limit. They kind of have to brainstorm.
Fun.
It's to like squeeze innovation out of you or whatever.
I love that the prompt is just make something new. Just make something. Anything. Just make it.
Like, you combine technology and art and see, you know, whatever. And they did make something new. So McCoy is an artist who often saw his work widely shared on sites like Tumblr, and it led him to think a lot about issues of ownership in the digital realm. And he wondered, you know, how an artist can assert control over their work in this kind of environment. So he realized that the solution to digital art's fungibility issue could lie in like the newly adapted blockchain technology. So do you know what a blockchain is?
No, fuck off. No, I don't. I had like an internship once where I actually did have to like kind of research what blockchains were. And I literally was like, fuck off to my computer. I was like, no, it's just no. It's something to do. No, I'm not even going to try.
No, like I'm going to say right here and now that I had a very similar experience researching this episode. I had to consult my little brother, who's much more in the loop than I am, to kind of fact check. And he confirmed that everything I'm about to say is factually true, but not, you know, in depth. And I admit that and I accept that. But when I tried to read the blockchain Wikipedia page, I thought I was reading Latin. So that's where we are. But in the simplest of terms, blockchains are like a decentralized database. They were first used to host cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, but they can technically be used to store all kinds of data. So rather than being overseen and hosted by like a single entity or computer, they're communally run by a network of computers. So, you know, if one computer got hacked or like went down or something happened, all of that information would still exist on these other computers. And so there's no kind of single overseer or like regulatory body looking over the blockchain, which is why people use them for something like cryptocurrency, because cryptocurrencies have no like nationality, like they don't belong to anything. And somehow the blockchain technology makes things really secure. My little brother explained that it was like because you can add data to it, but you can't take things out. I don't know what that means, but it's like chains of information. I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry.
Whenever we try to do an episode about tech, people get so mad at us.
That's when I'm get waiting the most for them to
infiltrate our old, they go to our old comment sections and they're like, and it'll just be quite funny to see.
And like, I tried to understand this stuff, guys, but like, for someone who knew nothing about NFTs before researching this episode, I feel really proud of myself for even knowing what I know. Okay.
So I'm very proud.
I'm not lazy. Okay. I tried.
That's the first thing they're all going to say.
I'm simply one girl who dropped out of science and math in grade 10. So, you know.
Grade 10?
Well, whenever I was able to do it, I took yearbook instead of science. Let's just, okay.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there is always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Coming to North America on August 16th is Swedish filmmaker Ernst Degir's directorial debut, The Hypnosis. When app developer Vera undergoes a hypnotism to help her quit smoking, she emerges as a different person, untethered from all inhibitions, just in time for a weekend-long business workshop with her concerned boyfriend. If you enjoy awkward coming-of-age stories like Frances Ha or The Worst Person in the World, then I highly recommend The Hypnosis. Its protagonists will subject you to endless secondhand embarrassment, but you will walk away with a fondness, maybe even some jealousy, over her newly found joie de vie. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/rehash. That's mubi.com/rehash for a whole month of great cinema for free.
So, with all of this in mind, now that we really understand how blockchains work, Kevin McCoy and Anil Dash, the artist and technologist at 7on7, concocted a way to apply this blockchain technology to digital objects. Like we've established, it's basically impossible for a single unique image to exist online because everything is shareable. But what is possible is creating and storing an uncopyable file on the blockchain that is linked to that image that sort of proves ownership. So when people are using the blockchains, they're using crypto, they have these like wallets, and that's how that kind of links them to the data that's in the chains, and it indicates like what they own, how much of it. And I guess that through this system, they made it so they could basically give people almost deeds of ownership over certain digital objects. So like I could make an NFT, mint an NFT of like a picture of your face. The picture of your face is free for public consumption. Anybody can do whatever they want with that picture. But if I've minted it and sold it to somebody, what they have is like sort of a little thing saying that they are the owner of the original of that picture.
And where is the original coming from? The original JPEG?
The one that was minted. So there's websites like OpenSea where people mint NFTs. Like, it doesn't even matter what the like original file is so much as it just matters that once
there's
that's
a minted,
minted
file and then there are non-minted files and you have the minted file.
Kieran, my little brother, explained it to me as basically like owning a star. Right? You're not going to put that star in your pocket. You can't really do much with that star, but people will buy certificates that say that star belongs to that person.
Oh, but that's so romantic.
But you could buy your loved one a bored ape. Actually, you couldn't. You couldn't afford it. But
bitch!
No, none of us could. So when they came up with this idea, they didn't call it an NFT. They called them monetized graphics. And when they presented it to the crowd at the new museum, that whole idea of the monetized graphic was laughed at. The art crowd.
That is bold to tell a bunch of people at an art museum this idea.
But in their case, these guys were just thinking of ways for artists to be able to make money off of their work, which was going to be existing online anyways, and which they had very little control over where their work went, and they couldn't really exert ownership.
Oh yeah, it's well-intentioned, but just telling it to the establishment elites is funny.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. They never ended up like patenting this idea either, and they didn't really manage to like get it to take off at the time. But flash forward a few years, and roughly that exact same system that they invented that night is used to create and sell what are now known as NFTs.
And the thing is, monetized graphics actually makes so much more sense to me, and it's way more, like, the language and the terminology actually computes, whereas, like, NFT, I'm like, what is that, you know?
I almost feel like there's a rejection of, like, accessibility. It's, like, all supposed to confuse you a little bit.
Well, yeah, you don't want everyone in there. You don't like want these NFT, two bitches in there.
It's an acronym for a term that most people don't understand. It's like supposed to kind of be something that makes you go, huh? Tech gatekeeping.
Tech jargon, for sure.
So in 2017, 3 years after McCoy and Dash invent the NFT, these two guys, Matt Hall and John Watkinson of the software company Larva Labs, embark on a fun little project. They develop a software that generates unique characters using combinations of different features programmed into the software, and these characters are called CryptoPunks. So each CryptoPunk looks like they're from an 8-bit computer game, and their features and accessories are all inspired by like steampunk and sci-fi aesthetics. So they create 10,000 of these CryptoPunks in total, and they keep 1,000 for themselves. I'm gonna send you some so you can get a sense of what they look like.
Oh, they remind me of this dress-up website that I used to play on that were like these little ladies, you know, and it was like just a white screen with a bunch of little paper dolls at the bottom. Do you remember that?
Maybe they kind of remind me of, you know, that game where it's like the girl, the little kind of 8-bit girl that lives in the house.
Oh, also her.
So how would you describe them? Like, they look like old video game characters, right?
Well, yes, that's exactly how I describe them.
Oh yeah. Okay. Each CryptoPunk is unique, and they make it so certain features are more rare than others, and so in that sense they become more valuable. So like only some will have alien skin, which is like some of them look like aliens, or like only some will have this combination of accessories, but like they're just little avatars basically.
They're very simple variations of the other, like it's easy to just kind of change them up very slightly and they're all of a sudden a different avatar.
Yes, but do you want to guess how much a floor CryptoPunk, meaning like kind of an average common CryptoPunk, was going for at their peak?
500k.
Okay, 150k.
To be fair to myself, you made it sound like it was gonna be really bad
before. I mean, 150k for
is very bad.
For a cartoon is,
I mean, very good, depending on who you are.
I mean, depending on who you are. Do you want to guess what the most expensive CryptoPunk went for?
$1 million.
$23.7 million.
That's fucked.
Is that crazy?
That is very crazy. But, like, because I'm at this stage in the realm of NFTs, I'm not shocked because I know how crazy it got. But that is insane. When we really think about it, if I were to transport my brain back to this time, what year would this have been?
2021, 2022 is, like, when it hit to the absolute,
take me
like,
back
apex.
A couple years, and I'd be like, do a shitter on the ground.
But even so, I knew that they were expensive. I didn't think that $23 million is, like, that is an insane amount of money to wrap your head around. But c'est la vie. So coming up around the same time as CryptoPunks were other NFT collections like CryptoKitties and...
Sorry, what's CryptoKitties?
Oh, they're so fugly. Like,
that sounds like... I won't lie to you, but you know what that sounds like, right?
I'm going to send you... So CryptoKitties and Bored 8 Yacht Club like came up around the same time. And yes, Bored 8 Yacht Club is hideous, but these are so much more ugly.
Wow, didn't think that was possible, to be honest.
No, you're gonna hate this.
Oh my god.
They're just like ugly cartoon cats.
They're just a bunch of like cockeyed cats. Like they were like, let's take the features of like the ugliest cat you know, and that's the cat.
And the thing is that like the Bored Ape and the CryptoPunks, and like I think these are ugly, but I can see some kind of hype beast like douchebag thinking that these look sick.
Well, yeah, it's like those guys who collect bear bricks, like those fugly ass dolls, like hype beast dolls. It feels kind of like that.
Yeah, well, this whole time it was making me think about Sunny Angels, those kind of figurines that you'll buy the surprise boxes for, and there are some are more rare than others. I remember when you were kids, there's these ones called Hellcats and Hellkitties, or no, Hellcats, I think, and they were like different kind of devil cat figurines, but then sometimes you'd get like an angel or something, and it was like rare.
Those were really fun, but yeah, it has that kind of collector's kind of like trading aspect to it, which I think makes so much sense when you think about that in relation to like economics and to like the world of trading, you know?
Oh, totally. And so like these specific types of NFTs, like the
That was the stupidest thing I've ever said.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't.
Well, that's what trading is. It's just different types of trading. It's like that time that I said that I
literally went, yes, exactly. This is two dumb bitches saying yes back and forth.
Well, yes. Okay, proceed.
So this specific genre of NFTs are kind of known as like community NFTs. So the CryptoPunks, the Bored Apes, the CryptoKitties, they're kind of like when you think of NFTs as sort of collectibles in the sense of like trading cards or those bear bricks or Beanie Babies, you know, it's about like having a collection of like one single thing. Like people will collect Bored Apes and you want like the more valuable ones, you want the more exciting rare ones, but like to have one means you're like part of like a special club. It's less about art. Like there's less of a kind of a veil of it being about like appreciating art, and it really is more just like a status thing. Like people use them as their profile pictures. A lot of celebrities got really into Bored Ape. And Bored Ape also like implements a bit more like tangible perks. Like you're sort of part of like special clubs by having Bored Apes.
Name them. Which celebrities got into Bored Ape?
I'm going to send you the most kind of dystopian video. It made the rounds back when it came out in 2022, when people were like, ew, what the hell's going on with NFTs? But yeah, you're going to hate this.
I jumped in.
I know, I heard. I'm so happy I taught you what they were.
You did. You taught me what's up, and then I bought an ape.
I got an ape, too, because I saw you on the show with Beeple, and you said you got a MoonPay, so I went and I copied you and did the same thing.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
That's your ape. Are we debuting?
It's really cool. Like the hat, the shades.
Now, how did you pick? Because you can pick your ape.
Yes, I was going through a lot of them, and I was like, I want something that like kind of reminds me of me, but this one does. I think we made like another version of it where he takes the hat off and blonde hair comes out.
So this is a clip of Paris Hilton on Jimmy Fallon. She got really into NFTs like kind of pretty early on and like has been really on that grind. So she had gone on previously to promote an NFT to Jimmy Fallon. She was trying to convince him to get a Bored Ape. And when she comes back this time, he's gotten one. So it's them basically discussing their individual Bored Apes that they own, but it's like such a scripted ad for NFTs, essentially.
Like, surely no one's taking that seriously, but everyone was like, yes, Paris!
Yeah, Paris ends the segment with telling everyone that they are getting their own NFTs.
But what does that mean?
It means that they're going to own the deed
to... fugly image?
Like, yeah, the deed to an image that, you know, Paris Hilton is giving this to you, you could probably resell, right? Like, the people in this crowd could probably make a few $1,000s off of selling these Paris Hilton NFTs that they got.
Who was sitting there when NFTs first came out with these little, like, avatars, and they were like, me, I am a man with $20 million, I'm going to buy that. They're buying it for the resale value.
Yeah, I think crypto and NFTs especially, like, they get called a gold rush a lot. So with something like the CryptoPunks, for example, like, the first round of them were given up for free. It was basically like whoever claimed them could take them. And then as NFTs started building hype, the people who owned those were selling them. And once you see the value of something of a similar style sell for a lot of money, like, you might then go, oh, if I buy this, it'll only go up in value. Right?
Yeah,
everyone totally just thinks they're trying.
You're actually just explaining economics to me, unfortunately. It has come to that.
I mean, and the idea of me explaining economics to fucking anybody is the funniest thing I've ever heard.
Listen, I didn't get into economics in grade 12. And then in university, I was thinking about doing a certain strain of poli sci that required microeconomics. And I was like, legitimately, fuck no, and did something else. And so here I am, knowledgeless. And I spend my time at family gatherings telling my cousin who works in business that the economy's fake because I can't see it. And
I love doing that.
I love doing that.
If there's any economy that is fake, it's crypto, because none of that is real money at the end of the day. So yeah, like, tons of celebrities, like big celebrities, were buying Bored Apes, making them their profile pictures. I know Snoop Dogg got really into NFTs. I think Jay-Z might have had one on his profile picture at one point. Like,
of course he did.
Because they're, at the end of the day, just like blatant status symbols. And it's a way for online to show that you have status, which is harder to do than in person, right? With these specific NFTs, which are the NFTs that are the most kind of well-known, right? That was sort of what you were picturing when you thought of an NFT. It's the clearest case of, like, yeah, these are basically Beanie Babies, or these are like when we used to trade, oh my God, what are they called? What were those wristbands that...
Oh, the silly bands.
Silly bands. And they were shaped like different things and, like, whatever. I'd be like, oh, I have two of this. I'll trade you two for this.
The thing is, a lot of these references are for children, except Beanie Babies famously became a phenomenon amongst mothers. But, like, a lot of these things are children's things.
But I think ultimately, like, with these NFTs, like, besides being status symbols, for a lot of people, it was them jumping on because they thought that this could be their way to get rich quick. And for some, they certainly did. But in order to buy them, once the stock started going up, you already had to have money, right? You would have to get in really early on an NFT to get it and not feel like you were risking, like, a lot in order to invest in it. So yeah, this is one side of the NFT. And at their highest, the most expensive Bored Ape went for $3.4 million. But that is nothing once you hear about Beeple.
Oh, no.
Have you heard about Beeple?
I love the timidity with which you asked me that.
Okay, so Beeple, or Mike Winkleman, is a graphic designer who gained an online following for creating and posting an illustration every day over the course of 13 years. And what's interesting about this series is, like, it allows you to sort of track his growth and development as an artist and sort of see how changing computer technologies contributed to how his styles changed. So it starts with hand-drawn illustrations in the first set.
Oh, so you're
kind of flipping through. If you go down to, like, the first collection, that'll show you his earlier work, which is more like hand-drawn. And he does them in sort of like series or like collections, and you see as they sort of change over time. He gets really into like computer graphics, like 3D.
They're quite irreverent.
They get very surreal.
Surreal and like kind of have a political edge to them.
But then some of them are just of like shapes and colors and vibes. And before he got into the NFT world, Beeple was finding success just through the sort of online following. He was designing prints that were being used in like collections for Louis Vuitton. He was designing stages for artists like Travis Scott. But then he also was still doing these every day. They get very political during the Trump years, but they're like kind of disgusting.
Yeah, they're vile.
What do you think of this work?
Like, it's not my personal taste, but it's very much like internet art. Like, it has that leaning to it.
Yeah, totally. Which, yeah, in a piece for the New York Times, Josie Thaddeus-Johns describes his style as one that, quote, piques the native tongue of the cadre of meme-literate speculators, many of whom have made huge sums from tech and crypto investments.
Wow.
It's like meme art, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And this also might explain why Beeple has had such a successful venture into NFTs. That's an understatement. What if I told you that in 2021, this man became the third most valuable living artist after Jeff Koons and David Hockney?
That's fucking insane.
More than Banksy, even.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow.
Which, I mean, Banksy is already people sort of like participating in a bit of mass psychosis.
But like, not.
But at least
you can see it with Banksy. You understand early on before it started becoming like a parody of itself. Like,
yeah,
why people were like, wow, you know.
Beeple learned about NFTs around the same time as a lot of us in late 2020, and he swiftly joined the trend. So he began doing drops of NFTs almost immediately, and the second round of them, he like broke the record for digital art within 5 minutes, make millions. A few months later, the series of like doing a drawing every day are called Everydays, and a collage of them, of like all of them together, called Everydays, the first 5,000 days, was minted as an NFT and put up for auction at Christie's, which made it the first time the auction house had ever sold a solely digital object. Guess how much this went for?
50 million.
69 million.
Fuck. Oh, it's 69 too? God, he must have been million. So happy that day for so many reasons.
I know. Like, I'm surprised at how few people made a joke about that in articles reporting this. So this NFT is literally just a photo collage of pictures, like something you might make in Picnic, of these 5,000 images.
Not Picnic.
The man who bought it said he had never stepped foot in an art gallery. Wow. So how does this all make you feel? Like, checking in on you now that we're learning so much about NFTs, like, how are we feeling?
I do need to be checked in on. Unfortunately, it's just, like, we already knew that the world of art was all about money and the transfers of money and moving money and money, money, money. So I guess we already knew that, but at least, yeah, at least it had kind of, like, the facade of caring about skill and caring about taste and caring about art itself, and now we're seeing that the facade has dropped, and behind it is just one big dollar sign dancing around with like a top hat on.
Whoa, that sounds like a Banksy print.
Honestly, this guy probably made an image of that dollar sign for sure with the top hat on.
That 3D,
feels
being eaten by Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah, being eaten by Donald Trump, who has two boobs, and the boobs are also Donald Trump's head. That's kind of like that's what we're getting from this guy. If I could summarize his work,
it's pretty grotesque. Like, opening this up in the cafe, like his art, I was like, ew.
I like grotesque. Like, I'm a huge fan of abject art. I love art that's like textured and disgusting and makes me want to vom. Like, I love that. But it has this like gloss to it that I hate about like movies that lean too heavily on CGI. Like, it just feels like that. And it's not.
Well, it
not
is even CGI.
Right. Yeah. Well, but of course. So, well, there you go.
Obviously, the sale was very controversial because, you know, the successful marriage of NFTs and like the legacy art institutions like Christie made very strange bedfellows out of affluent old money art collectors and then like little tech dweebs. And it also posed some bigger philosophical questions about the nature of art itself. So in 2017, an online gallery announced the auction of an NFT that they called Ready Made Token, which was said to be created by none other than Richard Prince.
Oh, he's back again. He feels like the Swiper or the Fox of this podcast.
So whack-a-mole.
I hope he comes up more.
News of this led Prince to tweet, "I have no idea what a blockchain is. That's why I have one. Or not. I'm not sure. Maybe I do and don't realize it. Anyway, I still don't know what it is."
Why do I love him a little? Like, there's something so cartoonish about him that I kind of, like, I got a respect in a way.
I mean...
Didn't Emily Ratajkowski also sell an NFT of herself?
With the Richard Prince print? I believe so.
God, it gets so meta. But isn't the satisfying, you know, finale episode, it all comes back around? How can we get Rupi Kaur in on this, too?
Except Richard Prince, he didn't have a blockchain. He didn't sell an NFT.
He was being for real.
His name and his title as the King of Appropriation were used by the team behind this online gallery called the Distributed Gallery as a sort of joke because they wanted to use a name when they were minting their own sort of NFT and they thought that his was the perfect name to steal.
So the appropriator got appropriated.
Yeah, they were like, who funnier basically to kind of steal from than Richard Prince? So they used the girls his who know name know. To wow. add clout to their coin as like a experiment.
Wow, they handed his ass back to him.
Yeah. But the project itself was actually not a commentary on Prince's work. That was sort of just a gag. Instead, it was meant to be a play on Marcel Duchamp's Ready Mades by, quote, granting a sacredness to a random commodity through the performative gesture of an artist. The ready-made tokens turn a cryptographic unit of value into an artwork the same way Duchamp elevated a common object to the status of artwork. So Duchamp's ready-mades began as a series of sculptures created by taking functional manufactured objects like a shovel or a bicycle wheel and presenting them as art by like mounting them or titling them. And in the process of taking away their functionality and like choosing to repurpose them as art, they then become art. So it's about sort of art as like a choice rather than a creation. And can you see the parallels that are being made here between crypto, which is something that we've sort of decided to like assign value to, and fine art? Like, do you see what they're getting at with that?
Yeah, totally. It's the arbitrary assigning of value to an object, but in this case, like a non-object, and like imbuing it, therefore, with like a spiritual value. And I think that's what we're definitely seeing here. I think that's what we saw on the stage of Richard Prince. I think that's what we see with Duchamp for sure. The slightest transformation of something in order to imbue it with value, or like the way that the thing exists, you know what I mean? Like the way it's moved, the way it's viewed, the way it's obtained. All of those things triangulate to like make it a piece of art.
Yeah.
And not the actual making of it and the skill behind the person who did so.
Yeah, I think it kind of gets to the separation between like the commercial value of art and the artistic value of art. And I thought this was like a really interesting comparison, but then I found sort of a counter argument, an article for October Magazine by this writer called David Joslett, where he argues that NFTs are basically the reversal of what Duchamp achieved with his ready-mades. So while yes, Duchamp took ordinary things and like stripped away their functionality and then labeled them as art, in turn giving them value, he points out how like much of his early ready-mades ended up getting lost or disappearing and leaving behind what he calls profiles of information. So no one can really buy these missing objects. And through their displacement, like all we're left with is the discourse, which is free. And like easily transferable, and then in a sense, it's fungible again. Like Duchamp took possessions and transformed them into art. He compares that to Beeple selling a collage of his illustrations, which were already available for free consumption online, as privately owned NFTs, essentially just takes art and transforms it into possession. So
it takes like what was with Duchamp, taking something private, making it public, like a private toilet, making it available for consumption in a gallery versus a collage that was available online for free consumption and making that private by, selling it for millions of dollars.
And then with Duchamp, because his work went missing, it's like what's left really is like the lore of it. It's like what it lends us as something to talk about, which is complete. You don't even need to go to a gallery to access that. So like it kind of evades commercialization. Whereas Beeple is making memes about things going on in the world, making them available for public consumption. They're very accessible. And then turning them into something that you can own, that you can buy. Like commercializing off of something that like originally was somewhat ephemeral, right?
Well, I'm thinking about like, I was like, oh, well, maybe we're having a discourse now about, you know, people's art. But then it's like, we're not actually talking about people's art. We're talking about the commercial possession of his art. It's not really about the art anymore.
And I don't think that in selling his art as an NFT, people was trying to inspire discourse, whereas like Duchamp was making this art to make us question like what the whole deal with art is, you know?
Yeah.
Another quote from this article, he says, here, art has been deployed as the ideological mechanism by which the previously mobile production of people is made into private property, susceptible to exuberant speculation. In other words, the category of art is equated with non-fungibility. It is the ready-made reversed. And yeah, it kind of takes this approach that like something is art because it can be purchased through an auction house, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. If Duchamp can turn a product into art through redefining and treating it as such, then like, do you think that the opposite effect can take place? Like once an art becomes a form of currency, which NFTs essentially are, there's something you trade. Has it not then like been repurposed? Like, can we even call it art?
I think if it's something like, I think it's like redefining what art means or taking one facet of art and making that the entire definition of it. By calling an NFT art, like if we were to do that, like I said, it's triangulating like all of the things that have to do with how it's like obtained rather than what it is inherently. And I think for me, art, and I guess I say this all the time, but like is something that like makes me question something or makes me think about the human condition or makes me think, you know what I mean? But it's also something that I can view and see and like engage with myself. And I think that's not really the purpose of an NFT. The purpose of an, like, you don't even ever have to look at an NFT to really care about its function. You know what I mean? All it's doing there is making you money. But like, you could make that argument for the wider art world and like the world of art sales as well. You know, like millionaires laundering their money through art. You know what I mean? Not giving a fuck about the actual things. Like sometimes a really valuable piece of art will stay in its packaging. You know what I mean? Never make it out because it's just constantly being moved around. So it's like, I guess maybe NFTs kind of exposed that reality of the art world. But no, with that in mind, like I think even though that is a facet of the art world and of art sales, art itself still exists. And I think NFTs are taking away from that a little bit.
Yeah, totally. I think a lot of people who are trying to defend NFTs love to equate it to sort of the art world and a lot of sort of luxury industries. There's a lot of things that seem very arbitrary to the way that they operate, to the way that like value is ascribed to, you know, when I think about people paying thousands of dollars for a bottle of wine, I'm like, but even if you drank a cheaper bottle of wine, like I have a hard time understanding the difference in experience. And then you think about people filling up a wine cellar full of $1,000 bottles of wine that, yeah, they might not drink for years, or people buying Jordans that they never take out of the box just to kind of be resold. And they are status symbols. Well, it's
commodity fetishism. Yeah.
Absolutely. But at the end of the day, if one day the time comes and I decide I'm going to put on that pair of Jordans, I'm going to drink that bottle of wine, I can, right? Like, yes, we're being sold an idea, but there is something. There is like something tangible that is being associated with it. Whereas like with an NFT, like what you're buying is ownership of something basically ephemeral. You, at the end of the day, don't have anything but this sort of thing indicating that you own it. Like, there's no utility that you could get from it at all. Yeah. If you decided to go, fuck it, I'm going to just enjoy this thing I bought. While NFTs were imagined up with like sort of pure intentions of helping more artists profit from their digital works, they haven't really played out that way. A lot of people now see like the kind of heyday of the NFT, which happened only a few years ago, as this bubble that burst. So besides like the more philosophical things we've listed, can you think of any like practical shortcomings of NFTs? For one, they're like really bad for the environment. All of crypto is. Because multiple computers are being worked at once to mine crypto, it just uses a lot of energy, basically. In 2021, Bitcoin was found to be using more power annually than Argentina, the country. Even people who are really excited about the prospect of an NFT for the art world can admit that like they need to find like a greener approach, which I don't know if that's gonna happen. Yeah, they're really bad for the environment. They're also a hotbed for scams, which I'm sure does not come as a surprise. Because crypto is decentralized, there isn't a lot of restitution for theft. So people are often being scammed into giving away the passwords to their crypto wallets through phishing scams and having someone immediately take and then resell their NFTs. And once someone does that, like, you can't get it back. You can't get any financial restitution. Like, you're fucked.
Because it's not associated with the banks, It's also super, super volatile.
And they move quickly. Yeah, people are anonymous. Like, it's gone. And then for artists, like, plagiarism has been a huge issue for NFTs. OpenSea, one of the biggest NFT marketplaces, is filled with NFTs made from stolen art off of platforms like DeviantArt. So they don't charge users for a fee for minting work unless it gets sold. So scammers will just, like, take tons of art, mint them as NFTs, and then wait for someone to buy one. And, like, hopefully someone buys one and you make a few hundred dollars or, like, a few thousand dollars off of it. It got so bad that DeviantArt, like, put in a feature that scanned blockchains for people's work so they can see if they've been plagiarized. Another common scam is users buying and selling an NFT to themselves to, like, falsely inflate value. And this actually brings us back to Beeple. So the man who bought the Everydays for $69 million, Vignesh Sundaresan, he's behind a Singapore company called Metapurse, which before this sale had bought 20 of Beeple's NFTs, which they had added to this sort of NFT bumble that could be invested in through the purchase of their cryptocurrency, which Beeple himself had a 2% stake in. So basically, Beeple was in business with the man who spent $69 million on his NFT. And together, like, they, you know, might have had a pretty good reason to want to increase its value. But the thing is it's kind of hard to regulate this the same way you would with, like, fraud in the actual art world, because it's being traded around with cryptocurrency. Like, I don't really know who would be the authoritative body overlooking this kind of stuff. And also, it's like, I don't really think that a lot of world governments are tapped in enough to the crypto world to, like, put that kind of stuff in place. And so I'm just going to end this off with a piece that Anil Dash, one of the inventors of the NFT, wrote for The Atlantic back in 2021, like, during the peak of the NFT, where he expressed his anxieties over the direction that they'd gone in. So unlike the artist Kevin McCoy, who was his co-creator, who later sold their original NFT that they made that night for over $1 million, Dash doesn't have any financial investment in NFTs. So he wrote in this article, I'm just going to end it off with this quote, "By devising the technology specifically for artistic use, McCoy and I hoped we might prevent it from becoming yet another method of exploiting creative professionals. But nothing went the way it was supposed to. Our dream of empowering artists hasn't yet come true, but it has yielded a lot of commercially exploitable hype. After a decade of whiplash-inducing changes in valuation, billions of dollars are now invested in cryptocurrencies, and the people who have made those bets can't cash in their chips anywhere. They can't buy real estate with cryptocurrency, they can't buy yachts with it. So the only rich person hobby they can partake in with their crypto wealth is buying art. And in this art market, no one is obligated to have any taste or judgment about art itself. If NFT prices suddenly plunge, these investors will try buying polo horses or Davos tickets with cryptocurrencies instead." There's a lot of kind of techno-utopians who, like, think that one day, like, we are all going to move into the metaverse and we're all going to be existing in this way, and that, like, national governments are going to take on cryptocurrencies and, like, we'll be able to spend it that way. But, like, babe, it's not happening anytime soon. And I think a lot of people are going to find themselves kind of freaking out because they invested a lot of money in these currencies that are losing value as time passes, that they kind of thought were, like, their golden tickets, you know?
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see. The tech utopians are really an op of this podcast.
They're an op. The problem is that, like, once enough buzz happens around with them, it kind of trickles down to normal people who I think also probably, like, some people probably made some missteps in investing in crypto.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Didn't you have a Bitcoin or something?
Yeah, yeah. My brother, for Christmas, he bought me some crypto. So I have an investment in crypto, yeah, and it's gone up a bit. But, like, I don't check it often enough, so honestly, who's to say? But, yeah.
Time for you to buy some NFTs. I hear that they're getting cheaper.
I want a monkey with a little bow on it and a blunt coming out of its mouth. I think the lesson of this episode is just go play with your Beanie Babies, because that's becoming more valuable by the day. I can't believe we finished this season. But this one felt quick.
It went by so fast. I don't know why.
What are some, like, takeaways that we've...
What are some roses and thorns?
What's your rose and thorn of the season? But yeah, I'm just, like, thinking about, like, the through line between these episodes. What have we really, like, learned about what happens when art meets the internet, you know?
Well, I like that a lot of the topics that we covered this season don't necessarily feel as thematically connected as I think past seasons have, in that we are really seeing, like, a more diverse array of, like, the kind of meetings of these two things. I think, obviously, like, one sort of takeaway is that perhaps, like, going back to your favorite Walter Benjamin essay, I do think that something is perhaps lost in trying to translate art to the internet, be it streaming films online, posting photography on Instagram, you know, watching a pro cut of a musical. Like, I do think that what we've encountered is that it makes these things easier to access, but perhaps less special at times.
Less special, and I think we're also seeing kind of agency being placed more into the hands of the artists, and then also simultaneously being taken away from the artist themselves. Yeah, I just think that the internet is this kind of next stage in mechanical reproduction, and exacerbates a lot of the issues that came with digitization, because now it's in this realm where, like, in one way anything goes and it's kind of the Wild West, but in another it's, like, extremely regulated, and now it's becoming, like, a marketplace to make jobs and to make money. And so we're seeing, like, a lot of opposing forces kind of at play with art meeting the internet. And I hope that this season didn't feel too doomsday as our other seasons sometimes have. I think that there is some optimism here.
I think for as much as, you know, a lot of the season is about how the internet has become, like, the primary location and setting through which we consume art, but that I do think that in reaction to that, there is pushback, and there is something kind of, like you're saying, like, optimistic about seeing people find value in enjoying things IRL, I suppose.
Yeah.
I can't believe we did this whole season and no one talked about Microsoft Paint.